The boys were all away at college now. The usual drivers, official cars, and now armed bodyguards. Because, remarkably enough, there were people about who didn't much care for admirals. As a theater commander, Mancuso now reported directly to the Secretary of Defense, Anthony Brentano, who in turn reported directly to President Ryan. In return, Mancuso got a lot of new perks. Now he had direct access to all manner of intelligence information, including the Holy of Holies, sources and methods, where the information came from, and how we'd gotten it out. Because, as America's principal executor for a quarter of the globe's surface, he had to know it all, so that he'd know what to advise the SecDef, who would, in turn, advise the president of SyncPAC's views, intentions, and desires. The Pacific, Mancuso thought, having just completed his first morning intel brief, looked okay. It hadn't always been like that, of course, including recently, when he'd fought a fairly major conflict. War was a word that had fallen very much out of favor in civilized discourse, with the Japanese, and that had included the loss of two of his nuclear submarines, killed with treachery and deceit, as Mancuso thought of it, though a more objective observer might have called the tactics employed by the enemy clever and effective. Heretofore, he'd been notified of the locations and activities of his various submarines, but now he also got told about his carriers, tin cans, cruisers, and replenishment ships, plus Marines and even Army and Air Force assets, which were technically his as a theater commander-in-chief. All that meant that the morning intel brief lasted into a third cup of coffee, by the end of which he looked longingly to the executive head, just a few feet away from his desk. Hell, his intelligence coordinator, called a J-2, was in fact an Army one-star doing his joint tour, and in fairness doing it pretty well. This brigadier, named Mike Lahr, had taught political science at West Point, in addition to other assignments. Having to consider political factors was a new development in Mancuso's career, but it came with the increased command territory. SyncPAC had done his joint tour along the way, of course, and was theoretically conversant with the abilities and orientation of his brother armed services. But whatever confidence he'd had along those lines diminished in the face of having the command responsibility to utilize such forces in a professional way. Well, he had subordinate commanders in those other services to advise him. But it was his job to know more than just how to ask questions. And for Mancuso, that meant he'd have to go out and get his clothes dirty, seeing the practical side, because that was where the kids assigned to his theater would shed blood if he didn't do his job right. The team was a joint venture of the Atlantic Richfield Company, British Petroleum, and the largest Russian oil exploration company. The last of the three had the most experience, but the least expertise, and the most primitive methods. This was not to say that the Russian prospectors were stupid. Far from it. Two of them were gifted geologists, with theoretical insights that impressed their American and British colleagues. Better still, they'd grasped the advantages of the newest exploration equipment about as quickly as the engineers who'd designed it. It had been known for many years that this part of eastern Siberia was a geological twin to the North Slope region of Alaska and northern Canada, which had turned into vast oil fields for their parent countries to exploit. The hard part had been getting the proper equipment there to see if the similarity was more than just cosmetic. Getting the gear into the right places had been a minor nightmare. Brought by train into southeastern Siberia from the port of Vladivostok, the thumper trucks, they were far too heavy to airlift, had then spent a month going cross-country, north from Magdagachi, through Aym and Ust-Maya, finally getting to work east of Kazachia. But what they had found had staggered them. From Kazachia, on the river Yana, all the way to Kolymskaya, on the Kolyma, was an oil field to rival the Persian Gulf. The thumper trucks and portable computer-carrying seismic survey vehicles had shown a progression of perfect underground dome formations in stunning abundance, some of them barely 2,000 feet down, mere tens of vertical yards from the permafrost. And drilling through that would be about as hard as slicing a wedding cake with a cavalryman's saber. The scope of the field could not be ascertained without drilling test wells. Over 100 such wells, the chief American engineer thought, just from the sheer scope of the field. But no one had ever seen as promising or as vast a natural deposit of petroleum during his professional lifetime. The issues of exploitation would not be small ones, of course. Except for Antarctica itself, there was no place on the planet with a less attractive climate. Getting the production gear in here would take years of multi-stage investment, building airfields, probably building ports for the cargo ships that could alone deliver the heavy equipment. And then, only in the brief summer months, needed to construct the pipeline which would be needed to get the oil out to market. Probably through Vladivostok, the Americans thought. The Russians could sell it from there, and supertankers, more precisely called VLCCs or ULCCs, for very large to ultra-large crude carriers, would move it out across the Pacific, maybe to Japan, maybe to America or elsewhere, wherever oil was needed, which was just about everywhere. From those users would come hard currency. It would take many more years until Russia could build the wherewithal needed for its own industries and consumers to use the oil. But as such things happened, the cash generated from selling the Siberian crude could then be flipped and used to purchase oil from other sources, which would be much more easily transported to Russian ports and thence into existing Russian pipelines. The cash difference of selling and buying, as opposed to building a monstrous and monstrously expensive pipeline, was negligible in any case, and such decisions were usually made for political rather than economic reasons. At precisely the same time, and only 600 miles or 960 or so kilometers away, another geology team was in the eastern extreme of the Sayan mountain range. Some of the semi-nomadic tribes in the area, who had made their living for centuries by herding reindeer, had brought into a government office some shiny yellow rocks. Few people in the world have been unaware of what such rocks mean, at least for the preceding 30 centuries, and a survey team had been dispatched from Moscow State University, still the nation's most prestigious school. They had been able to fly in since their equipment was far lighter, and the last few 100 kilometers had been done on horseback, a wonderful anachronism for the survey team of academics, who were far more used to riding Moscow's fine subway system. The first thing they'd found was an 80-ish man living alone with his herd and a rifle to fend off wolves. This citizen had lived alone since the death of his wife, 20 years before, quite forgotten by the changing governments of his country, known to exist only by a few shopkeepers in a dreary village 30 kilometers to the south, and his mental state reflected his long-term isolation. He managed to shoot 3 or 4 wolves every year, and he kept the pelts as any hunter-herdsman might, but with a difference. First he took the pelts, and weighting them down with stones, set them in the small river that ran near his hut. In Western literature, there is the well-known story of Jason and the Argonauts, and their heroic quest for the Golden Fleece. It was not known until recently that the legend of the artifact sought was quite real. The tribesmen of Asia Minor had set the skins of sheep in their streams to catch the gold dust being washed down from deposits higher up, changing the pale wool fibers into something almost magical in appearance. It was no different here. The wolf pelts the geologists found hanging inside the old soldier's hut looked on first inspection to be sculptures by Renaissance masters, or even artisans of the pharaohs of dynastic Egypt, they were so evenly coated, and then the explorers found that each pelt weighed a good 60 kilograms, and there were 34 of them. Sitting down with him over the necessary bottle of fine vodka, they learned that his name was Pavel Petrovich Gogol, that he'd fought against the fascisti in the great patriotic war as a sniper, and remarkably was twice a hero of the Soviet Union for his marksmanship, mainly in the battles around Kiev and Warsaw. A somewhat grateful nation had allowed him to return to his ancestral lands. He was, it turned out, descended from the entrepreneurial Russians who'd come to Siberia in the early 19th century, where he'd been forgotten by the bureaucrats, who never really wondered much where the reindeer meat eaten by the locals came from, or who might be cashing his pension checks to buy ammunition for his old bolt-action rifle. Pavel Petrovich knew the value of the gold he found, but he'd never spent any of it, as he found his solitary life quite satisfactory. The gold deposit, a few kilometers upstream from the place where the wolves went for their last swim, as Pavel Petrovich described it with a twinkle in the eye and a snort of vodka, turned out to be noteworthy, perhaps as much as the South African strike of the mid-19th century, and that had turned into the richest gold mine in the history of the world. The local gold had not been discovered for several reasons, mainly relating to the dreadful Siberian climate, which had, first, prevented a detailed exploratory survey, and second, covered the local streams with ice so much of the time that the gold dust in the stream beds had never been noticed. Both the oil and rock survey teams had traveled into the field with satellite phones, the more quickly to report what they found. This both teams did, coincidentally on the same day. The Iridium satellite communication system they used was a huge breakthrough in global communications. With an easily portable instrument, one could communicate with the low-altitude constellation of dedicated communications satellites which cross-linked their signals at the speed of light, which was almost instantaneous, but not quite, to conventional communications birds, and from there to the ground, which was where most people were most of the time. The Iridium system was designed to speed communications worldwide. It was not, however, designed to be a secure system. There were ways to do that, but they all required the individual users to make their security arrangements. It was now theoretically possible to get commercially available 128-bit encryption systems, and these were extremely difficult to break even by the most sophisticated of nation-states and their black services. Or so the salesman said. But the remarkable thing was that few people bothered. Their laziness made life a lot easier for the National Security Agency, located between Baltimore and Washington at Fort Meade, Maryland. There, a computer system called Echelon was programmed to listen in on every conversation that crossed the ether, and to lock in on certain code words. Most of those words were nouns with national security implications. But since the end of the Cold War, NSA and other agencies had paid more attention to economic matters, and so some of the new words were oil, deposit, crude, mine, gold, and others, all in 38 languages. When such a word crossed Echelon's electronic ear, the continuing conversation was recorded onto electronic media and transcribed, and, where necessary, translated, all by computer. It was by no means a perfect system, and the nuances of language were still difficult for a computer program to unravel, not to mention the tendency of many people to mutter into the phone. But where a goof occurred, the original conversation would be reviewed by a linguist, of which the National Security Agency employed quite a few. The parallel reports of the oil and gold strikes came in only 5 hours apart, and made their way swiftly up the chain of command, ending in a flash priority Special National Intelligence Estimate, called a SNE, destined for the President's desk right after his next breakfast, to be delivered by his National Security Advisor, Dr. Benjamin Goodley. Before that, the data would be examined by a team from the Central Intelligence Agency's Directorate of Science and Technology, with a big assist from experts on the payroll of the Petroleum Institute in Washington, some of whose members had long enjoyed a cordial relationship with various government agencies. The preliminary evaluation, carefully announced and presented as such, preliminary, lest someone be charged for being wrong if the estimate proved to be incorrect someday, used a few carefully chosen superlatives. "Damn," the president observed at 8:10 Eastern Standard Time. "Okay, Ben, how big are they really?" "You don't trust our technical weenies?" the National Security Advisor asked. "Ben, as long as I worked on the other side of the river, I never once caught them wrong on something like this. But damned if I didn't catch them underestimating stuff." Ryan paused for a moment. "But Jesus, if these are lowball numbers, the implications are pretty big." "Mr. President," Goodley was not part of Ryan's inner circle, "we're talking billions. Exactly how many, nobody knows. But call it $200 billion in hard currency earnings over the next 5 to 7 years at minimum. That's money they can use." "And at maximum?" Goodley leaned back for a second and took a breath. "I had to check. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion. On the sunny side of that number. This is pure speculation, but the guys at the Petroleum Institute that CIA uses, the guys across the river tell me, spent most of their time saying, 'Holy shit!'" "Good news for the Russians," Jack said, flipping through the printed snee. "Indeed it is, sir." "About time they got lucky," POTUS thought aloud. "Okay, get a copy of this to George Winston. We want his evaluation of what this will mean to our friends in Moscow." "I was planning to call some people at Atlantic Richfield. They were in on the exploration. I imagine they'll share in the proceeds. Their president is a guy named Sam Sherman. Know him?" Ryan shook his head. "I know the name, but we've never met. Think I ought to change that?" "If you want hard information, it can't hurt." Ryan nodded. "Okay, maybe I'll have Ellen track him down." Ellen Sumter, his personal secretary, was located 15 feet away through the sculpted door to his right. "What else?" "They're still beating bushes for the people who blew up the pimp in Moscow. Nothing new to report on that, though." "Would be nice to know what's going on in the world, wouldn't it?" "Could be worse, sir," Goodley told his boss. "Right." Ryan tossed the paper copy of the morning brief on his desk. "What else?" Goodley shook his head. "And that's the way it is this morning, Mr. President." Goodley got a smile for that. Chapter 4. Knob Rattling. It didn't matter what city or country you were in, Mike Riley told himself. Police work was all the same. You talked to possible witnesses. You talked to the people involved. You talked to the victim. But not the victim this time. Grisha Avseyenko would never speak again. The pathologist assigned to the case commented that he hadn't seen such a mess since his uniformed service in Afghanistan. But that was to be expected. The RPG was designed to punch holes in armored vehicles and concrete bunkers, which was a more difficult task than destroying a private passenger automobile, even one so expensive as that stopped in Dzerzhinsky Square. That meant that the body parts were very difficult to identify. It turned out that half the jaw had enough repaired teeth to say with great certainty that the decedent had indeed been Grigory Filipovich Avseyenko, and DNA samples would ultimately confirm this. The blood type also matched. There hadn't been enough of his body to identify. The face, for example, had been totally removed, and so had the left forearm, which had once borne a tattoo. The decedent's death had come instantaneously, the pathologist reported, after the processed remains had been packed into a plastic container, which in turn found its way into an oaken box for later cremation, probably. The Moscow militia had to ascertain whether any family members existed, and what disposition for the body they might wish. Lieutenant Provolov assumed that cremation would be the disposal method of choice. It was, in its way, quick and clean, and it was easier and less expensive to find a resting place for a small box or urn than for a full-sized coffin with a cadaver in it. Provolov took the pathology report back from his American colleague. He hadn't expected it to reveal anything of interest, but one of the things he'd learned from his association with the American FBI was that you checked everything thoroughly, since predicting how a criminal case would break was like trying to pick a 10-play football pool 2 weeks before the games were played. The human minds who committed crimes were simply too random in their operation for any sort of prediction. And that had been the easy part. The pathology report on the driver had essentially been useless. The only data in it of any use at all had been blood and tissue types, which could be checked with his military service records, if they could be located, since the body had been so thoroughly shredded as to leave not a single identifying mark or characteristic. Though perversely, his identity papers had survived in his wallet, and so they probably knew who he had been. The same was true of the woman in the car, whose purse had survived virtually intact on the seat to the right of her, along with her ID papers, which was a lot more than could be said for her face and upper torso. Riley looked at the photos of the other victims. Well, one presumed they matched up, he told himself. The driver was grossly ordinary, perhaps a little fitter than was the average here. The woman, yet another of the pimp's high-priced hookers with a photo in her police file, had been a dish, worthy of a Hollywood screen test, and certainly pretty enough for a Playboy centerfold. Well, no more. "So, Mishka, have you handled enough of these crimes that it no longer touches you?" Provolov asked. "Honest answer?" Riley asked, then shook his head. "Not really. We don't handle that many homicides, except the ones that happen on federal property, Indian reservations or military bases. I have handled some kidnappings, though, and those you never get used to." Especially, Riley didn't add, since kidnapping for money was a dead crime in America. Now children were kidnapped for their sexual utility, and most often killed in 5 hours, often before the FBI could even respond to the initial request for assistance from the local police department. Of all the crimes which Mike Riley had worked, those were by far the worst, the sort after which you retired to the local FBI bar. Every field division had one, and had a few too many as you sat quietly with equally morose and quiet colleagues, with the occasional oaths that you were going to get this mutt no matter what it took. And mostly the mutts were apprehended, indicted, and then convicted. And the lucky ones went to death row. Those convicted in states without a death penalty went into the general prison population, where they discovered what armed robbers thought of the abusers of children. "But I see what you mean, Oleg Grigorievich. It's the one thing you have trouble explaining to an ordinary citizen." It was that the worst thing about a crime scene or autopsy photo was the sadness of it, how the victim was stripped not merely of life, but of all dignity. And these photos were particularly grisly. Whatever beauty this Maria Ivanovna Sablin had once had was only a memory now, and then mainly memories held by men who'd rented access to her body. Who mourned for a dead whore? Riley asked himself. Not the Johns, who'd move on to a new one with scarcely a thought. Probably not even her own colleagues in the trade of flesh and desire. And whatever family she'd left behind would probably remember her not as the child who'd grown up to follow a bad path, but as a lovely person who'd defiled herself, pretending passion, but feeling no more than the trained physician who'd picked her organs apart on the dented steel table of the city morgue. Is that what prostitutes were, Riley wondered? Pathologists of sex? A victimless crime, some said. Riley wished that such people could look at these photos and see just how victimless it was when women sold their bodies. "Anything else, Oleg?" Riley asked. "We continue to interview people with knowledge of the deceased," followed by a shrug. "He offended the wrong people," an informant said, with a shrug of his own that showed how absurdly obvious the answer to the preceding question was. How else could a person of Avseenko's stature turn up dead in so spectacular a way? "And what people are they?" the militiaman asked, not expecting a meaningful answer. "But you asked the question anyway because you didn't know what the answer was until you did." "His colleagues from state security," the informant suggested.
"Oh?
Who else could have killed him in that way? One of his girls would have used a knife. A business rival from the street would have used a pistol or a larger knife, but an RPG? Be serious. Where does one get one of those?" He wasn't the first to voice that thought, of course, though the local police did have to allow for the fact that all manner of weapons, heavy and light, had escaped one way or another from the coffers of what had once been called the Red Army into the active marketplace of criminal weapons.
"So, do you have any names for us?" the militia sergeant asked.
"Not a name, but I know the face. He's tall and powerfully built, like a soldier. Reddish hair, fair skin, some freckles left over from his youth. Green eyes." The informant paused. "His friends call him the boy, because his appearance is so youthful. He was state security once, but not a spy and not a catcher of spies. He was something else there, but I am not sure what." The militia sergeant started taking more precise notes at this point, his pencil marks far more legible and much darker on the yellow page.
"And this man was displeased with Avseenko?"
"So I have heard."
"And the reason for his displeasure?"
"That I do not know, but Grigory Filipovich had a way of offending men. He was very skilled at handling women, of course. For that he had a true gift, but the gift did not translate into his dealings with men. Many thought him a Zhopnik, but he was not one of those, of course. He had a different woman on his arm every night, and none of them were ugly. But for some reason he didn't get along well with men, even those from state security, where he said he was once a great national asset."
"Is that a fact?" the militia sergeant observed, bored again.
If there was anything criminals liked to do, it was boast. He'd heard it all 1,000 times or more. "Oh, yes. Grigory Filipovich claims to have supplied mistresses for all manner of foreigners, including some of ministerial rank, and says that they continue to supply valuable information to Mother Russia." "I believe it," the informer added, editorializing again. "For a week with one of those angels, I would speak much."
"And who wouldn't?" the militiaman wondered with a yawn.
"So how did Avseenko offend such powerful men?" the cop asked again. "I have told you I do not know. Talk to the boy, perhaps he will know." "It is said that Grigory was beginning to import drugs," the cop said next, casting his hook into a different hole, and wondering what fish might lurk in the still waters. The informant nodded.
"That is true. It was said. But I never saw any evidence of it."
"Who would have seen evidence of it?"
Another shrug.
"This I do not know. One of his girls, perhaps. I never understood how he planned to distribute what he thought about importing. To use the girls was logical, of course, but dangerous for them.
and for him, because his whores would not have been loyal to him in the face of a trip to the camps.
So then, what does that leave? The informant asked rhetorically.
He would have to set up an entirely new organization, and there were also dangers in doing that, were there not? So yes, I believe he was thinking about importing drugs for sale, and making vast sums of money from it. But Grigori was not a man who wished to go to a prison. And I think he was merely thinking about it, perhaps talking a little, but not much. I do not think he had made his final decision. I do not think he actually imported anything before he met his end.
Rivals with the same ideas? The cop asked next.
There are people who can find cocaine and other drugs for you, as you well know.
The cop looked up. In fact, the militia sergeant didn't know that for certain. He'd heard rumbles and rumors, but not statements of fact, from informants he trusted, insofar as any cop in any city truly trusted any informant. As with many things, there was a buzz on the streets of Moscow, but like most Moscow cops, he expected it to show up first in the Black Sea port of Odessa, a city whose criminal activity went back to the Tsars, and which today, with the restoration of free trade with the rest of the world, tended to lead Russia in, well, led Russia to all forms of illicit activity.
If there was an active drug trade in Moscow, it was so new and so small that he hadn't stumbled across it yet. He made a mental note to check with Odessa, to see what, if anything, was happening down there along those lines.
And what people might they be? The sergeant asked.
If there was a growing distribution network in Moscow, he might as well learn about it.
Nomori's job for Nippon Electric Company involved selling high-end desktop computers and peripherals. For him, that meant the PRC government, whose senior bureaucrats had to have the newest and best of everything, from cars to mistresses, paid for in all cases by the government, which in turn took its money from the people, whom the bureaucrats represented and protected to the best of their abilities. As in many things, the PRC could have bought American brands, but in this case it chose to purchase the slightly less expensive and less capable computers from Japan, in the same way that it preferred to buy Airbus airlines from the European maker rather than Boeing's from America. That had been a card played a few years before to teach the Americans a lesson. America had briefly resented it, then had quickly forgotten about it, in the way America seemed to handle all such slights, which was quite a contrast to the Chinese, who never forgot anything. When President Ryan had announced the reestablishment of their official recognition of the Republic of China government on Taiwan, the repercussions had thundered through the corridors of power in Beijing like the main shocks of a major earthquake. Nomori hadn't been here long enough yet to see the cold fury the move had generated, but the aftershocks were significant enough, and he'd heard echoes of it since his arrival in Beijing. The questions directed at himself were sometimes so direct and so demanding of an explanation that he'd momentarily wondered if his cover might have been blown, and his interlocutors had known that he was a CIA illegal field officer in the capital of the People's Republic of China, entirely without a diplomatic cover. But it hadn't been that. It was just a continuing echo of pure political rage. Paradoxically, the Chinese government was itself trying to shove that rage aside, because they too had to do business with the United States of America, now their number one trading partner, and the source of vast amounts of surplus cash, which their government needed to do the things which Nomori was tasked to find out about. And so here he was, in the outer office of one of the nation's senior officials.
"Good day," he said, with a bow and a smile to the secretary.
She worked for a senior minister named Fang Gan, he knew,
whose office was close by. She was surprisingly well-dressed for a semi-ordinary worker, in a nation where fashion statements were limited to the color of the buttons one wore on the Mao jacket that was as much a part of the uniform of civilian government workers as was the gray-green wool of the soldiers of the People's Liberation Army.
"Good day," the young lady said in reply. "Are you Nomuri?"
"Yes, and you are?"
"Lian Ming,"
the secretary replied.
An interesting name, Chester thought. Lian in Mandarin meant graceful willow. She was short, like most Chinese women, with a squarish face and dark eyes. Her least attractive feature was her hair, short and cut in a manner that harkened back to the worst of the 1950s in America, and then only for children in Appalachian trailer parks. For all that, it was a classically Chinese face in its ethnicity, and one much favored in this tradition-bound nation. The look in her eyes, at least, suggested intelligence and education.
"You are here to discuss computers and printers," she said neutrally, having absorbed some of her boss's sense of importance and centrality of place in the universe.
"Yes, I am. I think you will find our new pin matrix printer particularly appealing."
"And why is that?" Ming asked.
"Do you speak English?" Nomuri asked, in that language.
"Certainly," Ming replied, in the same.
"Then it becomes simple to explain. If you transliterate Mandarin into English, the spelling, I mean, then the printer transposes into Mandarin ideographs automatically, like this," he explained, pulling a sheet of paper from his plastic folder and handing it to the secretary. "We are also working on a laser printer system which will be even smoother in its appearance."
"Ah," the secretary observed.
The quality of the characters was superb, easily the equal of the monstrous typewriting machine that secretaries had to use for official documents, or else have them hand-printed and then further processed on copying machines, mainly Canons, also of Japanese manufacture. The process was time-consuming, tedious, and much hated by the secretarial staff.
"And what of inflection variations?"
"Not a bad question," Nomuri noted. The Chinese language was highly dependent on inflection. The tone with which a word was delivered determined its actual meaning from as many as 4 distinct options, and it was also a determining factor in which ideograph it designated in turn.
"Do the characters appear on the computer screen in that way as well?" the secretary asked.
"They can, with just a click of the mouse," Nomuri assured her. "There may be a software problem insofar as you have to think simultaneously in 2 languages," he warned her with a smile.
Ming laughed. "Oh, we always do that here."
Her teeth would have benefited from a good orthodontist, Nomuri thought. But there weren't many of them in Beijing, along with the other bourgeois medical specialties, like reconstructive surgery. For all that, he'd gotten her to laugh, and that was something.
"Would you like to see me demonstrate our new capabilities?" the CIA field officer asked.
"Sure. Why not?" She appeared a little disappointed that he wasn't able to do so right here and now.
"Excellent, but I will need you to authorize my bringing the hardware into the building. Your security people, you see."
"How did I forget that?" he saw her ask herself, blinking rather hard in a mild self-rebuke. Better to set the hook all the way.
"Do you have the authority for that? Or must you consult someone more senior?"
The most vulnerable point in any communist bureaucrat was their sense of importance of place. A knowing smile,
Oh, yes, I can authorize that on my own authority.
A smile of his own. Excellent. I can be here with my equipment at, say, 10 in the morning.
Good.
The main entrance. They will be awaiting you. Thank you, Comrade Ming, Nomori said with his best officious short bow to the young secretary. And probably mistress to her minister, the field officer thought. This one had possibilities, but he'd have to be careful with her both for himself and for her, he thought to himself while waiting for the elevator. That's why Langley paid him so much, not counting the princely salary from Nippon Electric Company that was his to keep. He needed it to survive here. The price of living was bad enough for a Chinese. For a foreigner it was worse, because for foreigners everything was, had to be, special. The apartments were special, and almost certainly bugged. The food he bought in a special shop was more expensive. And Nomori didn't object to that, since it was also almost certainly healthier. China was what Nomori called a 30-foot country. Everything looked okay, even impressive, until you got within 30 feet of it. Then you saw that the parts didn't fit terribly well. He'd found it could be especially troublesome getting into an elevator, of all things. Dressed as he was in Western-made clothing, the Chinese thought of Japan as a Western country, which would have amused a lot of people, both in Japan and the West. He was immediately spotted as a Kwai, a foreign devil, even before people saw his face. When that happened, the looks changed, sometimes to mere curiosity, sometimes to outright hostility, because the Chinese weren't like the Japanese. They weren't trained as thoroughly to conceal their feelings. Or maybe they just didn't give a damn, the CIA officer thought behind his own blanked-out poker face. He'd learned the practice from his time in Tokyo, and learned it well, which explained both why he had a good job with NEC and why he'd never been burned in the field. The elevator ran smoothly enough, but somehow it just didn't feel right. Maybe it was, again, because the pieces didn't quite seem to fit together. Nomori hadn't had that feeling in Japan. For all their faults, the Japanese were competent engineers. The same was doubtless true of Taiwan. But Taiwan, like Japan, had a capitalist system which rewarded performance by giving it business and profits and comfortable salaries for the workers who turned out good work. The PRC was still learning how to do that. They exported a lot. But to this point, the things exported were either fairly simple in design, like tennis shoes, or were manufactured mostly in strict accordance to standards established elsewhere, and then slavishly copied here in China, like electronic gadgets. This was already changing, of course. The Chinese people were as clever as any, and even communism could keep them down only so long. Yet the industrialists who were beginning to innovate and offer the world genuinely new products were treated by their government masters as, well, as unusually productive peasants at best. That was not a happy thought for the useful men who occasionally wondered over drinks why it was that they, the ones who brought wealth into their nation, were treated as unusually productive peasants. By the ones who deemed themselves the masters of their country and their culture. Nomori walked outside, toward his parked automobile, wondering how long that could last. This whole political and economic policy was schizophrenic, Nomori knew. Sooner or later, the industrialists would rise up and demand that they be given a voice in the political operation of their country. Perhaps, doubtless, such whispers had happened already. If so, word had gotten back to the whisperers that the tallest tree is quickly cut for lumber,
and the well with the sweetest water is first to be drunk dry. And he who shouts too loudly is first to be silenced. So maybe the Chinese industrial leaders were just biding their time and looking around the rooms where they gathered, wondering which of their number would be the first to take the risk. And maybe he would be rewarded with fame and honor, and later memories of heroism. Or maybe, more likely, his family would be billed for the 7.62x39 cartridge needed to send him into the next life, which Buddha had promised, but which the government contemptuously denied.
So they haven't made it public yet. That's a little odd, Ryan thought.
It is, Ben Goodley agreed with a nod.
Any idea why they're sitting on the news?
No, sir. Unless somebody is hoping to cash in on it somehow. But exactly how?
Cardsharp shrugged.
Buy stock in Atlantic Richfield? Some mine machine builder?
Or just buy options in some land in eastern Siberia, George Winston suggested.
Not that such a thing is ever done by the honorable servants of the people.
The president laughed hard enough that he had to set his coffee down.
Certainly not in this administration, POTUS pointed out.
One of the benefits the media had with Ryan's team was that so many of them were plutocrats of one magnitude or another, not working men. It was as if the media thought that money just appeared in the hands of some fortunate souls by way of miracle, or some unspoken and undiscovered criminal activity, but never by work. It was the oddest of political prejudices that wealth didn't come from work, but rather from something else, a something never really described, but always implied to be suspect.
"Yeah, Jack," Winston said with a laugh of his own. "We've got enough that we can afford to be honest. Besides, who the hell needs an oil field or gold mine?"
"Further developments on the size of either?"
Goodley shook his head.
"No, sir, the initial information is firming up nicely. Both discoveries are big. The oil especially, but the gold as well."
"The gold thing will distort the market somewhat," Sectrez opined. "Depending on how fast it comes on stream. It might also cause a shutdown of the mine we have operating in the Dakotas."
"Why?" Goodley asked.
"If the Russian strike is as good as the data suggests, they'll be producing gold for about 25% less than what it costs there, despite environmental conditions. The attendant reduction of the world price of gold will then make Dakota unprofitable to operate."
Winston shrugged.
"So they'll mothball the site and sit until the price goes back up. Probably after the initial flurry of production, our Russian friends will scale things back so that they can cash in a more, orderly way. What'll happen is that the other producers, mainly South Africans, will meet with them and offer advice on how to exploit that find more efficiently. Usually the new kids listen to advice from the old guys. The Russians have coordinated diamond production with the De Beers people for a long time, back to when the country was called the Soviet Union. Business is business, even for commies. So, you going to offer our help to our friends in Moscow?" Trader asked Swordsman.
Ryan shook his head.
"I can't yet. I can't let them know that we know. Sergei Nikolaevich would start wondering how, and he'd probably come up with SIGINT, and that's a method of gathering information that we try to keep covert." Probably a waste of time, Ryan knew, but the game had rules, and everyone played by those rules. Golovko could guess at Signal's intelligence, but he'd never quite know. "I'll probably never stop being a spook," the president admitted to himself. Keeping and guarding secrets was one of the things that came so easily to him. A little too easily, Arnie Van Dam often warned. A modern democratic government was supposed to be more open,
like a torn curtain on the bedroom window that allowed people to look in whenever they wished. That was an idea Ryan had never grown to appreciate. He was the one who decided what people were allowed to know and when they'd know it. It was a point of view he followed even when he knew it to be wrong, for no other reason than it was how he'd learned government service at the knee of an admiral named James Greer. Old habits were hard to break. "I'll call Sam Sherman at Atlantic Richfield," Winston suggested. "If he breaks it to me, then it's in the open, or at least open enough."
"Can we trust him?"
Winston nodded.
"Sam plays by the rules. We can't ask him to screw over his own board, but he knows what flag to salute, Jack."
"Okay, George, a discreet inquiry."
"Yes, sir, Mr. President, sir."
"God damn it, George! Jack, when the hell are you going to learn to relax in this fucking job?" Sec-Trez asked POTUS.
"The day I move out of this goddamned museum and become a free man again," Ryan replied with a submissive nod.
Winston was right. He had to learn to stay on a more even keel in the office of president. In addition to not being helpful to himself, it wasn't especially helpful to the country for him to be jumpy with the fol-de-rol of office holding. That also made it easy for people like the Secretary of the Treasury to twist his tail, and George Winston was one of the people who enjoyed doing that. Maybe because it ultimately helped him relax, Ryan thought. Backwards English on the ball or something. "George, why do you think I should relax in this job?"
"Jack, because you're here to be effective. And being tight all the time does not make you more effective. Kick back, guy, maybe even learn to like some aspect of it."
"Like what?"
"Hell."
Winston shrugged, and then nodded to the secretary's office.
"Lots of cute young interns out there."
"There's been enough of that," Ryan said crossly. Then he did manage to relax and smile a little.
"Besides, I'm married to a surgeon. Make that little mistake, and I could wake up without something important."
"Yeah, I suppose it's bad for the country to have the president's dick cut off, eh? People might not respect us anymore."
Winston stood.
"Gotta go back across the street and look at some economic models."
"Economy looking good?" POTUS asked.
"No complaints from me or Mark Gant. Just so the Fed chairman leaves the discount rate alone, but I expect he will. Inflation is pretty flat, and there's no upward pressure anywhere that I see happening."
"Ben?"
Goodley looked through his notes as though he'd forgotten something.
"Oh, yeah. Would you believe the Vatican is appointing a papal nuncio to the PRC?
"Oh, what's that mean exactly?" Winston asked, stopping halfway to the door.
"The nuncio is essentially an ambassador. People forget that the Vatican is a nation-state in its own right and has the usual trappings of statehood. That includes diplomatic representation. A nuncio is just that, an ambassador. And a spook," Ryan added.
"Really?"
Winston asked.
"George, the Vatican has the world's oldest intelligence service. Goes back centuries. And, yeah, the nuncio gathers information and forwards it to the Home Office, because people talk to him. Who better to talk to than a priest, right? They're good enough at gathering information that we've made the occasional effort to crack their communications. Back in the 30s, a senior crippy at the State Department resigned over it," Ryan informed his sec-trez, reverting back to history teacher.
"We still do that?"
Winston directed this question at Goodley, the president's national security adviser. Goodley looked first to Ryan and got a nod.
"Yes, sir. Fort Meade still takes a look at their messages. Their ciphers are a little old-fashioned, and we can brute-force them."
"And ours?"
"The current standard is called tap dance. It's totally random, and therefore it's theoretically unbreakable. unless somebody screws up and reuses a segment of it. But with approximately 647 million transpositions on every daily CD-ROM diskette, that's not very likely.
What about the phone systems?
The stew? Goodley asked, getting a nod.
That's computer-based, with a 256K computer-generated encryption key. It can be broken, but you need a computer, the right algorithm, and a couple of weeks at least. And the shorter the message, the harder it is to crack it, instead of the other way around. The guys at Fort Meade are playing with using quantum physics equations to crack ciphers, and evidently they're having some success. But if you want an explanation, you're going to have to ask somebody else.
I didn't even pretend to listen, Goodley admitted. It's so far over my head, I can't even see the bottom of it.
Yeah, get your friend Gant involved, Ryan suggested.
He seems to know pewters pretty well. As a matter of fact, you might want to get him briefed in on these developments in Russia. Maybe he can model the effects they'll have on the Russian economy.
Only if everyone plays by the rules, Winston said in warning. If they follow the corruption that's been gutting their economy the last few years, you just can't predict anything, Jack.
We cannot let it happen again, Comrade President, Sergei Nikolaevich said over a half-empty glass of vodka.
This was still the best in the world, if the only such Russian product of which he could make that boast. That thought generated an angry frown at what his nation had become.
Sergei Nikolaevich, what do you propose?
Comrade President, these two discoveries are a gift from heaven itself. If we utilize them properly, we can transform our country, or at least make a proper beginning at doing that. The earnings in hard currencies will be colossal, and we can use that money to rebuild so much of our infrastructure that we can transform our economy. If, that is, he held up a cautionary finger, if we don't allow a thieving few to take the money and bank it in Geneva or Liechtenstein. It does us no good there, Comrade President.
Golovko didn't add that a few people, a few well-placed individuals, would profit substantially from this. He didn't even add that he himself would be one of them, and so would his president. It was just too much to ask any man to walk away from such an opportunity. Integrity was a virtue best found among those to afford it, and the press be damned, the career intelligence officer thought. What had they ever done for his country or any other? All they did was expose the honest work of some and the dishonest work of others, doing little actual work themselves. And besides, they were as easily bribed as anyone else, weren't they?
And so who gets the concession to exploit these resources? The Russian president asked.
In the case of the oil, our own exploration company, plus the American company, Atlantic Richfield. They have the most experience in producing oil in those environmental conditions anyway, and our people have much to learn from them. I would propose a fee-for-service arrangement, a generous one, but not an ownership percentage in the oil field itself. The exploration contract was along those lines, generous in absolute terms, but no share at all in the fields discovered.
And the gold strike?
Easier still. No foreigners were involved in that discovery at all. Comrade Gogol will have an interest in the discovery, of course, but he is an old man with no heirs, and, it would seem, a man of the simplest tastes. A properly heated hut and a new hunting rifle will probably make him very happy, from what these reports tell us.
And the value of this venture?
Upwards of 70 billions. And all we need do is purchase some special equipment, the best of which comes from the American company Caterpillar.
Is that necessary, Sergei?
Comrade President, the Americans are our friends, after a fashion, and it will not hurt us to remain on good terms with their president.
And besides, their heavy equipment is the world's finest.
Better than the Japanese?
For these purposes, yes, but slightly more expensive, Golovko answered, thinking that people really were all the same. And despite the education of his youth, in every man there seemed to be a capitalist, looking for ways to cut costs and increase his profits, often to the point of forgetting the larger issues.
Well, that was why Golovko was here, wasn't it?
And who will want the money?
A rare chuckle in this office.
Comrade President, everyone wants to have money. In realistic terms, our military will be at the front of the line.
Of course, the Russian president agreed, with a resigned sigh. They usually are.
Oh, any progress in the attack on your car? He asked, looking up from his briefing papers.
Golovko shook his head.
No notable progress, no. The current thinking is that this Avseyenko fellow was the actual target, and the automobile was just a coincidence. The militia continues to investigate.
Keep me posted, will you?
Of course, Comrade President.
Chapter 5 Headlines. Sam Sherman was one of those whom age hadn't treated kindly, though he himself hadn't helped. An avid golfer, he moved from lie to lie via cart. He was much too overweight to walk more than a few hundred yards in a day. It was rather sad for one who'd been a first-string guard for the Princeton Tigers once upon a time. Well, Winston thought, muscle just turned to blubber if you didn't use it properly. But the overweight body didn't detract from the sharpness of his brain. Sherman had graduated about fifth in a class not replete with dummies, double majoring in geology and business. He'd followed up the first sheet of parchment with a Harvard MBA and a PhD from the University of Texas, this one in geology as well. And so Samuel Price Sherman could not only talk rocks with the explorers, but finance with his board members. And that was one of the reasons why Atlantic Richfield stock was as healthy as any oil issue in the known world. His face was lined by a lot of low sun and field grit, and his belly swollen by a lot of beers with the roughnecks out in many godforsaken places, plus hot dogs and other junk food preferred by the men who drifted into such employment. Winston was surprised that Sam didn't smoke, too. Then he spotted the box on the man's desk. Cigars. Probably good ones. Sherman could afford the best, but he still had the Ivy League manners not to light up in front of a guest who might be offended by the blue cloud they generated. Atlantic Richfield's home office was elsewhere, but as with most major corporations, it didn't hurt to have a set of offices in Washington, the better to influence members of Congress with the occasional lavish party. Sherman's personal office was in a corner on the top floor, and plush enough, with a thick beige carpet. The desk was either mahogany or well-seasoned oak, polished like glass, and probably cost more than his secretary made in a year or two.
"So, how do you like working for the government, George?"
"It's really a fun change of pace. Now I can play with all the things I used to bitch about. So I guess I've kind of given up my right to bitch."
"That is a major sacrifice, buddy," Sherman replied with a laugh. "It's kind of like going over to the enemy, isn't it?"
"Well, sometimes you gotta pay back, Sam, and making policy the right way can be diverting."
"Well, I have no complaints with what you guys are doing. The economy seems to like it."
"Anyway," Sherman sat up in his comfortable chair. It was time to change subjects. Sam's time was valuable, too, as he wanted his guest to appreciate.
"You didn't come here for small talk. What can I do for you, Mr. Secretary?"
"Russia." Sherman's eyes changed a little, as they might when the last card was laid in a high-stakes game of stud.
"What about it?"
You have a high-powered exploration team working with the Russians. They find anything nice?
George, that's sensitive stuff you're asking. If you were still running Columbus, this would constitute insider trading information stuff. Hell, I can't buy any more of our stock now based on this stuff.
Does that mean you'd like to? Trader asked with a smile.
Well, it'll be public soon enough anyway. Yeah, George, looks like we've found the biggest goddamned oil field ever. Bigger in the Persian Gulf. Bigger in Mexico. Damn sight bigger than Prudhoe Bay and Western Canada combined. I'm talking big, billions and billions of barrels of what looks like the very best light sweet crude just sitting there and waiting for us to pump it out of the tundra. It's a field we'll measure in years of production, not just barrels.
Bigger than the PG?
Sherman nodded. By a factor of 40%, and that's a very conservative number. The only beef is where it is. Getting that crude out is going to be a mother humper. To get started, anyway. We're talking $20 billion just for the pipeline. It'll make Alaska look like a kindergarten project. But it'll be worth it.
And your end of it? The Secretary of the Treasury asked.
That question generated a frown. We're negotiating that now. The Russians seem to want to pay us a flat consulting fee, like $1 billion a year. They're talking a lot less than that now, but you know how the hog trading works at this stage, right? They say a couple of $100 million, but they mean $1 billion a year, for 7 to 10 years, I'd imagine. And that isn't bad for what we'd have to do for the money. But I want a minimum of 5% of the find. And that's not at all an unreasonable request on our part. They have some good people in the geology business, but nobody in the world can sniff out oil and ice like my people can. And they've got a lot to learn about how to exploit something like this. We've been there and done that in these environmental conditions. Ain't nobody knows this like we do, even the guys at BP. And they're pretty good. But we're the best in the world, George. That's the barrel we have them over. They can do it without us, but with us helping, they'll make a ton more cash, and a hell of a lot faster. And they know that. And we know they know that. So I got my lawyers talking to their lawyers. Actually, they have diplomats doing the negotiating.
Sherman managed a grin.
They're dumber than my lawyers.
Winston nodded. Texas turned out more good private practice attorneys than most parts of America. And the excuse was that in Texas, there were more men needin' killin' than horses needin' stealin'. And the oil business paid the best. And in Texas, like every place else, talent went where the money was.
When will this go public? The Russians are trying to keep a cork in it. One of the things we're getting from our lawyers is that they're worried about how to exploit this one. Really, who to keep out of it, you know, their mafia and stuff. They do have some serious corruption problems over there, and I can sympathize.
Winston knew he could ignore the next part. The oil industry did business all over the world, dealing with corruption on the small scale, $10 million or less, or even the monstrous scale, $10 billion or more, was just part of the territory for such companies as Sam Sherman ran, and the United States government had never probed too deeply into that. Though there were federal statutes governing how American companies handled themselves abroad, many of those laws were selectively enforced, and this was merely one such example. Even in Washington, business was business.
And so they're trying to keep it quiet until they can make the proper arrangements, Sherman concluded.
You hearing anything else?
What do you mean? Sherman asked in reply.
Any other geological windfalls? Winston clarified.
No, I'm not that greedy in what I pray for. George, I haven't made it clear enough just how huge this oil field is. It's...
Relax, Sam. I can add and subtract with the best of 'em. Sec Trez assured his host.